and that cursed black junk was still hulking in the darkness off to port. Except that it wasn't dark. There was no moon. But the stars. You've never seen stars if you've only seen them from England. They don't twinkle faintly in the tropics, they blaze. And the sea. It was alive with phosphorescence. Our wake and our bow wave were great swirling tracks made up of billions of spots of white light, and all the sea on both sides was full of deep, glowing movements. Fishes darted through the depths, great shimmering clouds and veils of shadowy colour, little surges and whirlpools of light far below. Once or twice in your life you get a night like that, and it's a sight to leave you breathless. And the junk was the only thing in the whole glowing panorama that was dark. They had one reedy little yellow lantern swinging at the masthead. The rest was solid blackness, like a paper cutout, like a puppet in one of the shadow plays they have out there. And then Harding, the helmsman, says to me, "Mr. Bedwell, there's a man moving about midships." I went to the rail, careful not to make a sound, and sure enough, I saw a figure by the portside rail, in the act of climbing over and down into a boat bobbing by the side. I was about to call out, but in all that great wash of light, I recognised his face. It was the captain. I told Harding to stay where he was and raced down the companionway to Mr. Lockhart's cabin. It was locked. There was no answer when I banged on it, so I kicked the door down. And then... he stopped and looked at Sally. "I'm sorry, miss. He'd been stabbed." Sally felt a rush of anguish sweep up her chest, and tears flooded her eyes and blurred the little room. She shook her head angrily. "Go on," she said. "Don't stop." The cabin was overturned. All his papers were scattered on the floor. The bunk was torn open. His trunk was upside down. It was in chaos. And with the captain leaving the ship and the junk nearby, I was about to turn and run out to waken the crew when I heard a groan from the bunk. He was alive. Only just, but he stirred, and I tried to lift him up, but he shook his head. "Who did this, Mr. Lockhart?" I said. He said something I couldn't catch, and then he came out with two words that made my blood run cold. "Ah, Ling," he said. "The black junk. It's his ship. The captain." He could say no more for the moment. My mind was racing. Ah Ling, if it was his ship, then we were done for. Ah Ling was the most murderous, bloodthirsty savage in the South China Sea. I'd heard his name scores of times, and it was never spoken without a shudder. And then Mr. Lockhart spoke again. "Find my daughter, Bedwell. My daughter Sally. Tell her what happened." "I'm sorry, Miss Lockhart." He said some more things then, and they were all jumbled, or else I couldn't hear him clearly. I don't know. But he finished up. "Tell her to keep her powder dry." That's all I remember clearly. He said that, and then he died. Sally's face was wet. Those words, "keep your powder dry," were what he always said to her on leaving. And now he had left her forever. "It's all right," she said. "I'm listening. You must tell me everything. If I cry, take no notice. Go on." I gathered he dictated a letter to the servant, but I don't suppose it ever got here. "It did," said Sally. "That was what started it all." Bedwell rubbed his brow. Seeing that the sailor's glass was empty and that he was rapidly tiring, Frederick poured out the last of the brandy. "Thank you. Where was I? Well, the next thing that happened was that a strange pattering noise came from overhead, like big, soft raindrops, only it wasn't rain. It was bare feet running over the deck, and the next second a great wild cry came from poor Harding at the wheel, and then a sound of smashing wood. I ran up the companionway and stopped in the shadow at the top. The ship was sinking. There were 6 or 7 Chinese devils smashing in the lifeboats, and 2 or 3 of our crew stretched in their own blood on the deck. The ship was listing so much already that I saw one of those corpses start to move, almost as if it were alive, and slide down slowly into the water that was creeping up the deck to meet it. If I live 100 years, I'll never forget the sight of that ship. It's with me still, clearer than this room. I have only to close my eyes, and it's before me. The sea full of light, blazing with all the colours of the rainbow like a huge, slow firework display, with crisp little volleys of brightness wherever anything fell into the water, and a line of trembling white fire around the edge of the ship. The still black shape of the junk a little way off, and above us the stars. And they were all colours too, reds and yellows and blue-whites. And the dead men and their blood on the deck, and the pirates chopping swiftly at the boats, and the sensation of sinking, falling slowly into that great bath of light. I'm a slave to a terrible drug, Miss Lockhart. I've spent more days and nights in strange dreams than I care to think about. But nothing I've seen in the smoke has been stranger or more terrible than those few minutes I spent on the deck of the sinking Lavinia. And then I felt a hand tug my sleeve. I turned, and there was the servant Perak, finger to his lips.
"Come with me, Bedwell Twan," he whispered.
And I followed, helpless as a baby. God knows how he'd done it, but he'd lowered the captain's gig and it bobbed in the water over the stern. We got in and rowed away, just a little distance. Should I have stayed? Should I have tried to fight off the pirates? Bare-handed as I was, and then with cutlasses? I don't know, Miss Lockhart. I don't know. Then the pirates left and got into their boat and rowed off. The Lavinia was about to sink, and the rest of the crew, those who hadn't been cut to the deck, were struggling to free the lifeboats and crying out with rage and fear when they saw them stove in. The next minute the schooner went down, terribly fast, as if a great hand had thrust it into the water. There was an immense swirl and cries from the sailors as they fell into the sea. The gig was a small boat. It had held 7 or 8 at a pinch, but we could save some of them. I turned it round and rowed towards them. But when we were still 50 yards off, the sharks came. Poor devils didn't have a chance. They were a shiftless, lazy lot, but there was no harm in them. They were doomed before the voyage began. Pretty soon we were alone. The sea was strewn with bits of wreckage, splintered oars and broken spars and the like. We drifted through it all, feeling nothing. Feeling numb. Do you know, I think I even fell asleep. How that night passed, I've no idea. Nor why my luck held, so that a Malay fishing boat picked us up the next day. We had no food and no water. We wouldn't have lasted 24 hours. They put us ashore at their village, and then we found our way to Singapore, and there... He stopped and rubbed his eyes wearily. But he kept them closed and kept his hand over them. Frederick said quietly, "Opium?" Bedwell nodded. I made my way to a den and lost myself in the smoke. A week, 2 weeks, who knows? I lost Perak, too. I lost everything. When I came to myself again, I found a berth as able seaman on a London-bound steamer and, well, you know the rest. But you can see now why the ship was sunk. Not by a reef or a typhoon. Not for the sake of the insurance. This is how I see it. The word had gone out that Mr. Lockhart was aboard, searching around, making inquiries. Someone gave orders to muddle up the cargoes in Singapore so as to keep the ship in harbour for a week, while Ah Ling and his foul crew made haste to come and meet us. Sinking the ship was just a way of concealing your father's murder. One death on its own would look suspicious, but one among many in a shipwreck, especially if there's no body to examine, well, it looks more like an act of God. The 2 days sailing out of Singapore I can't understand, but one thing I've learned in the East is that nothing's done without a reason. Something made them hold off till the night of the 30th, when they could have attacked us any time before that. Though I suppose it did get us clear of the shipping lanes. Someone organized all that. Someone powerful and ruthless. Someone close to Singapore. It's my guess that the secret society I told you about was at the bottom of it. They have the most terrible penalties for their enemies, or those who betray them. But what they're hiding... There was a silence. Sally got up and crossed to the fire and put a shovelful of coal on the embers, stirring them up into a bright blaze. Mr. Bedwell, is it possible... When you take opium, I mean, is it possible for your memory to recall things you'd forgotten? It's happened many times. As if I were living them again. But I don't need opium to remember that night the Lavinia went down. Why do you ask? Oh, it was something I'd heard. But there's another thing. These secret societies, triads, are they called? That's right. And you said the firm's agents were members of one. Rumoured to be. Do you know which one it was? I do. And that was where I'd heard the name of Ah Ling the pirate. He was said to be a headman of the same society. It was called the Fan Lin Society, Miss Lockhart. The Seven Blessings. Arms and the Girl. Next morning, Sally went out for a walk to think over what Matthew Bedwell had told her. It was damp and cold, and the mist in the air seemed to dull the sound of the traffic. She walked slowly down towards the British Museum. So, her father had been murdered. She had suspected it, of course. Bedwell's story only confirmed her fears. But it was more difficult to unravel now, not less. For even though the meaning of the Seven Blessings was clear now, why should that society have needed to become involved with a shipping firm? And what secret did they have that was so precious that several men's deaths were necessary to keep it hidden? Mr. Higgs had known. Did Mr. Selby? And who was this stranger, the man from the Warwick Hotel, whose letter had so frightened him? And then there was her father's dying message. Keep your powder dry. Be prepared, that meant. Stay on guard. Well, she'd been doing that, and she'd carry on doing it. But it didn't explain anything. She wished Mr. Bedwell had remembered the other things her father had said. Any little clue would have been better than nothing. Perhaps it would come back to him when he'd recovered under his brother's care. She hoped so, profoundly. She arrived at the British Museum and wandered up to the flight of steps. Pigeons pecked among the columns. Three girls, a little younger than herself, under the care of a governess, climbed the steps, talking cheerfully. She, with her thoughts of sudden death and guns, did not belong in that calm and civilized place. She turned back to Burton Street. There was something she wanted to ask Trembler. She found him in the shop, arranging a display of portrait frames. She heard Rosa's laughter from the kitchen, and Trembler told her that the Reverend Nicholas had arrived.
"I knew I'd seen him before," he said. "Two or three year ago, in Sleeper's Gymnasium it was, just when the Marquess of Queensbury's rules come in, he made a wager with Bonnie Jack Foggan, one of the old bare-knuckle boys. They fought 15 rounds, him with gloves on and Foggan without, and he won, though he was terrible marked."
"The other man had bare fists."
"Aye, and that was his undoing. See, the gloves protects your hands as well as the other fella's face. And after 15 rounds, he was punching a hell of a lot harder than Foggan, in spite of Bonnie Jack pickling his fist for years. I remember the punches laid him out. A lovely right cross, and that was the end of it, and the triumph of the Queensbury rules. Of course, Mr. Bedwell wasn't a reverend then. Did you want something, miss?"
"Yes. Trembler, do you know where I can get a gun? A pistol?" He blew through his moustache, a trick he had when he was surprised.
"Depends what sort," he said. "I suppose you mean a cheap one?"
"Yes, I've only got a few pounds, and I can't really go into a gunsmith's myself. They'd probably refuse to sell me one. Could you buy one for me?
You know how to use a pistol, do you?
Yes, I had one. But it was stolen, I told you.
I saw you did. Well, I'll see what I can do.
If you'd rather not, I can ask Frederick to do it, but I thought that you might know someone.
Someone in the criminal way, you mean?
She nodded.
Well, I might. I'll see.
The door opened, and Adelaide came in with some newly printed stereographs. Trembler's expression changed, and a huge gap-toothed smile appeared under his moustache.
"Here's my lady love," he said. "Where you been?"
"I've been with Mr. Garland,"
she said, and then saw Sally.
"Morning, miss,"
she whispered. Sally smiled and went through to join the others. On Wednesday afternoon, 2 days after the stranger had got off the boat, Mrs. Holland had a visit from Mr. Selby. This was quite unexpected. She hardly knew the etiquette for the polite reception of a blackmail victim, but she did her best.
"Come in, Mr. Selby," she said, beaming yellowly. "Cup of tea?"
"Very kind," muttered the gentleman. "Thank you."
They exchanged civilities for some minutes until Mrs. Holland began to lose her patience.
"Well now," she said, "out with it. I can see as you're bursting to tell me some good news."
"You're a clever woman, Mrs. Holland. I've conceived an admiration for you in the short time of our acquaintance. You've got hold of something about me. I won't deny it."
"You can't," said Mrs. Holland.
"I wouldn't if I could. But there's richer pickings than me. You've got a hold of the edge of something. How'd you like to get your hands on the rest of it?"
"Me?"
she said in mock astonishment.
"I ain't the party involved, Mr. Selby. I'm just the broker. I should have to put any proposal to my gentleman."
"Well, of course," said Mr. Selby impatiently. "The gentleman'll have to be consulted, if you insist. I don't see why you don't drop him and deal direct yourself. But it's your decision."
"That's right," said the lady. "Well, are you going to tell me all about it?"
"Not just straight off. Of course not. What do you take me for? I got to have my guarantees.
Same as you." "What do you want, then?"
"Protection. And 75%.
"Protection you can have. 75%, you can't. 40, yes."
"Ah, give over. 40, 60 at least."
They settled on 50% each, as both had known they would, and then Mr. Selby began to talk. He spoke for some time, and when he had finished, Mrs. Holland was silent, staring into the empty grate.
"Well?" he said.
"Oh, Mr. Selby, you are a one. You sound like you've been caught up in something bigger than what you expected."
"No, no," he said unconvincingly. "Only I'm a bit tired of that line now. The market's not what it was."
"And you want to get out while you're still alive, eh?"
"No, no. I only thought as it might be to our advantage to join forces. Kind of partnership."
She tapped her teeth with the toasting fork.
"Tell you what," she said. "You do one thing for me, and I'll come in with you."
"What?"
"Your partner Lockhart had a daughter. She must be, 16, 17 now."
"What do you know about Lockhart? Seems to me you know a bloody sight too much about everything."
She stood up.
"Goodbye, then," she said. "I'll send you my gentleman's next bill in the morning."
"No, no," he said hastily. "I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to offend. I'm sorry, Mrs. Holland."
He was sweating, a fact she observed with interest, for it was a cold day. Pretending to be mollified, she sat down again.
"Well, seeing as it's you," she went on, "I don't mind telling you that me and the Lockharts, father and daughter, is old friends. I've known that girl for years. The only thing is, I've lost touch. You find out where she's living now, and I'll see you won't lose by it.
But how am I going to do that?
That's your affair. And it's my price. That and 50%.
He frowned and growled and twisted his gloves and thumped his hat. But he was caught. Then another thought occurred to him.
Here, he said. I've told you a good deal, I have. Now what about you coming clean as well? Who's this gentleman of yours, eh? Where'd you hear all that stuff in the first place?
She peeled back her upper lip in a reptilian snarl. He flinched, and then realized that she was smiling.
"Too late to ask that now," she said. "We made the bargain already, and I don't recall as that was part of it."
All he could do was sigh. With the uneasy feeling that he had done the wrong thing, Mr. Selby got up to go, leaving Mrs. Holland smiling fondly at him like a crocodile with a new baby. And 10 minutes afterwards, Mr. Berry said to her,
"Who was the gent has left just now, Mrs. Holland?"
"Why?" she said. "Do you know him?"
"No, ma'am. Only he was being watched. A thick-set fella, fair-haired, as was hanging about by the cemetery. He waited till your gent left, and he made a note in a little book and followed him without being seen."
Mrs. Holland's roomy eyes opened, and then the lids came down again.
"Do you know, Mr. Berry," she said, "this is an interesting game we're in. I wouldn't miss this for the world."
It didn't take Trembler long to find Sally a gun. The very next day, while Adelaide was helping Rosa with some sewing, he beckoned Sally into the shop and thrust a brown paper parcel across the counter.
"Cost me £4,
he said.
"And there's powder and ball as well in there."
"Powder and ball?" said Sally, dismayed. "I was hoping for something more up to date." She gave Trembler the money and opened the parcel. The little box-lock pistol inside was no more than 6 inches long, with a short, stumpy barrel and a large, curved hammer. The handle was oak and fitted her hand neatly. And it did not seem badly balanced, and the maker's name, Stocker of Yeovil, was one she recognized, and the government proof marks were stamped under the barrel as they should be. But the top of the barrel around the nipple, where the percussion cap exploded, was deeply pitted and worn. A packet of powder, a little bag of lead bullets and a box of percussion caps completed the armoury.
"Ain't it any good?" said Trembler. "I gets very nervous around guns."
"Thank you, Trembler," she said. "I'll have to try it a few times, but it's better than nothing." She drew back the hammer, testing the strength of the spring, and looked down the narrow metal tube where the flash of the percussion cap was led to the powder. It needed a good cleaning, and it hadn't been fired for a long time. That barrel, she thought, looks distinctly frail.
"Sooner you than me," he said. "I'm off to clean the studio. We've got a sitting this morning."
The studio was a room hung with velvet drapes, against which subjects were posed uncomfortably in a horsehair armchair, or stiffly arm-in-arm beside an aspidistra. This morning, it was a young woman who wanted a picture to send to her fiancé, who was in the Baltic timber trade, and who came home only twice a year. Rosa had learned all this and more. She would draw people out for hours at a time. The customer arrived, with her mother for chaperone, at 11. Sally showed them into the studio where Frederick was setting up the big camera, and then borrowed some of his light oil and went into the kitchen to clean the gun. Adelaide joined Trembler in the shop and left her alone, but she hardly noticed. The smell of the oil, the feel of the metal under her fingers, the sensation of removing little by little all the obstructions which lay between a machine and its function, all gave her a feeling of calm, impersonal happiness. Finally, it was done, and she laid it down and wiped her hands. She would have to test it. She took a deep breath and let it out slowly. She was afraid of that corroded barrel. The mechanism was in order, the trigger moved cleanly, the hammer swept down precisely on the right spot. Nothing was bent or twisted, nothing was cracked. But if the barrel could not contain the force of the explosion, she would lose her right arm. She tilted a quantity of the black, gritty powder into the barrel and tamped it down firmly. Then she tore off a little square of blue cloth from the hem of the dress Rosa had been altering and wrapped it round one of the balls of lead to ensure a snug fit. And then the ball joined the powder in the barrel and a patch of wadding followed it. She rammed them down hard and then took a percussion cap from the box, a little copper cylinder with a closed end containing a quantity of fulminate, a chemical compound which exploded when struck by the hammer. She pulled the hammer back until it had clicked twice, fitted the cap over the nipple, and then with extreme care held the hammer while she gently pulled the trigger. This let the hammer down halfway to a position where it was locked. Trembler and Adelaide were in the shop. Frederick was in the studio. Rosa had gone to the theatre. There was no one to watch and distract her. She went out into the yard. There was a wooden shed with a peeling door that would do as a target. Checking that there was nothing in the shed but broken flower pots and empty sacks, she measured out 10 paces from the hut and turned. The air in the yard was chilly, and she was lightly clad. Images of a shattered arm, of blood spurting from torn flesh and splintered bone, insisted on crowding into her mind. But the hand she raised to aim the pistol was perfectly steady. She was satisfied. She pulled back the hammer one extra click to unlock it, and aimed at the center of the door. Then she squeezed the trigger. The gun leapt in her hand, but she was expecting that and had allowed for it. The huge bang and the smell of the powder were different from those she was used to, but close enough to delight her senses, and in the same split second she realized that the barrel had held, that she still had an arm and a hand, and that everything in the yard was the same as it had been before the shot, including the door of the shed. There was no bullet hole anywhere to be seen. Puzzled, she examined the pistol, but it was empty. Had she forgotten to put a ball in? No, she remembered the square of cloth from the blue dress. Then what had happened? Where had the ball gone? The door was big enough. In all conscience, she could have put a bullet through a visiting card at that distance. Then she saw the hole. It was 2 feet to the left of the door, and a foot from the ground. She had been aiming at roughly the height of her own head. She was glad her father had not seen that shot. But surely she hadn't let the recoil destroy her aim. She rejected the idea at once. She had fired hundreds of rounds. She knew how to fire a pistol. It must be the gun itself, she concluded. A short, wide, unrifled barrel just did not make for accuracy. She sighed. Still, at least she now had something which would make a loud noise and a smell of gunpowder, and it might serve to frighten anyone who attacked her. But she would only have one shot. The kitchen door opened, and Frederick came running out. "What the devil?" he began. "It's all right," she said. "Nothing's broken. Did you hear the noise inside?" "I should say we did. My fair client leapt out of the chair and almost out of the picture altogether. What are you doing?"
"Testing a pistol. I'm sorry."
"In the middle of London? You're a savage, Lockhart. I don't know what effect you'll have on Mrs. Holland, but by God, you terrify me!"
"That was the Duke of Wellington," he said more kindly, talking about his soldiers. "Are you all right?" He moved closer and put a hand on her shoulder. She was trembling all over now, and felt cold and hurt and angry with herself.
"Look at you," he said. "You're shaking like a leaf. How on earth can you shoot straight if you're trembling like that? Come inside and get warm."
"I don't shake when I'm going to shoot," she muttered, unable to find her voice, and she let herself be led inside like an invalid. "How can he be so stupid? How can he be so blind?" she thought, and simultaneously, "How can I be so feeble?" She said nothing, and sat down to clean the pistol. The Turk's Head. Mrs. Holland, in pursuance of her agreement with Mr. Selby, detailed one of her young men to look after him. This youth sat in the office, picking his nails and whistling tunelessly, and went to and fro with Mr. Selby, annoying everyone they met with his insistence on searching them for hidden weapons. Jim was vastly entertained, and made the young man search him every time he came into the office, which he did as often as possible, until Mr. Selby lost his temper and ordered him out. But tormenting Mr. Selby was only one of Jim's preoccupations. He spent a good deal of time in Wapping over the next few days. He made the acquaintance of a night watchman on the jetty by Aberdeen Wharf, who fed him information about Mrs. Holland in exchange for much-used copies of Stirring Tales for British Lads. The information was not very interesting, but it was something. And so were the snippets of news he gathered from the mudlarks, boys and girls who earned a living by picking up lumps of coal and other bits and pieces from the mud at low tide. They sometimes turned their attention to unguarded boats as well, but they seldom ventured very far ashore. They knew of Mrs. Holland, though, and they followed her movements with close attention. For instance, on the day after Sally tried out her new gun, they were able to tell Jim that Mrs. Holland and Mr. Berry had gone out in the morning, heading west and dressed against the cold, and that they hadn't yet returned. The origins of that particular expedition lay in the scraps of paper Mrs. Holland had received after their detour through the hands of Ernie Blackett. At first she had thought Sally had made up the message on purpose to mislead her, but the more she looked into the words, the more there seemed to be a kind of sense in them. But she was damned if she could see what. Finally, she lost patience.
"Come on, Mr. Berry," she said. "We're off to Swale Ness."
"What for, ma'am?"
"A fortune."
"Where is it?"
"I wish I bleeding knew."
"Then what are we going there for?"
"You know what, Jonathan Berry," she said passionately. "You're a fool. Henry Hopkins was flush and unreliable, but he wasn't a fool. I can't abide a fool."
"Sorry, ma'am,"
said Mr. Berry, feeling ashamed of himself without knowing why. Mrs. Holland's plan was to visit Foreland House and interrogate the drunken housekeeper, if she was still there, in the hope that she might know something. But after a muddy walk in the biting wind, they found the place empty and locked. Mrs. Holland cursed fluently for a good 10 minutes without repeating herself, and then lapsed into a moody silence as they tramped back towards the town. Halfway there, she stopped suddenly.
"Here," she said. "What's the name of that pub by the arbour?"
"Pub, ma'am? I don't recall seeing one," said Mr. Berry courteously.
"No, you wouldn't, I suppose, you pork brain water swiller. But if it's the Turk's Head, like I think it is..."
She spoke for the first time that day without venom, and Mr. Berry felt his spirits lifting. She was scrutinizing her piece of paper again.
"Come on," she said. "Do you know, Mr. Berry, I think I got it."
Stuffing the paper into her bag, she led off at a faster rate. Mr. Berry followed faithfully.
"If I tells you to drink a mug of beer, you'll bloody drink it,"
she said much later.
"I ain't having you sitting there like a bloody temperance meeting, swilling lemonade, a great big man like you. Why, it'd attract unwholesome attention. You do as you're told."
They stood outside the inn. It was dark, Mrs. Holland having insisted that they wait until sunset. She had spent the rest of the afternoon hanging about the harbour, where the fishing boats were rising slowly with the tide that flowed in up the creek. Mr. Berry had watched, bemused, as she spoke to one old fisherman after another, meaningless questions about lights and tides and such like. She was a marvel, and no error. But he wasn't going to drink beer without a fight.
"I got me principles," he said stubbornly. "I took the pledge, and that's good enough for me. I ain't drinking no beer."
Mrs. Holland reminded him in tuppence-coloured language that he was a thief, a thug, and a murderer, and she had only to snap her fingers and give him in charge, and what she knew would hang him inside a month. But he would not budge. Finally, she had to give in.
All right, she said bitterly. Lemonade, then. And I hope that little maggot of a thing you call your conscience is satisfied. Get inside, and don't breathe a word.
With the calm joy of the righteous, Mr. Berry followed her into the Turk's Head.
Drop a gin for me, dear, she said to the landlord. And a glass of lemonade for my son, what has a delicate stomach.
The landlord brought the drinks, and while Mr. Berry sipped his lemonade, Mrs. Holland engaged the man in conversation. A handsome situation he had here, facing out to sea like he did. An old pub, was it? With an old cellar, no doubt. Yes, she'd seen the little window by the step on the way in at ground level, and she'd had a little bet with her son that you could see the sea out of it. Was she right? Only at high tide. Well, fancy that. What a shame it was dark now. She couldn't prove it to him. A glass for the landlord? Go on, it was a cold night. Yes, pity it was dark now, and they'd be on their way in a little while. She'd like to win her bet. She could. How's that? There was a buoy in the creek. You could see it when the tide was in, and there was lights, was there, on the buoy. There, Alfred, to Mr. Berry, who sat befuddled. Will that prove it to you? Kicked. He nodded hard and surreptitiously rubbed his ankle.
Yes, mother, he said.
Exchanging a broad wink with Mrs. Holland, the landlord lifted the flap of the counter and let them through.
Down the steps, he said. You have a squint out the window, and you'll see it.
The cellar door was in a little passage behind the bar, and the steps were in darkness. Mrs. Holland struck a match and looked around.
Shut the door, she hissed up to Mr. Berry.
He pushed it to and stumbled down after her.
Careful, she said.
She blew the match out, and they stood on the steps in the dark.
What are we looking for?
He whispered.
A place of darkness, she whispered. That's this cellar. Under a knotted rope. That's the Turk's Head.
Eh?
A Turk's Head is a kind of knot. Didn't you know that? Of course you wouldn't. Three red lights. There's a buoy out there in the creek what flashes three times. When the moon pulls on the water. When the tide's in. See? It all fits. Now, all we got to do is look for the light.
Is that it, Mrs. Holland?
He was pointing at a small square of dim radiance in the blackness.
Where?
She said.
I can't see nothing. Get out of the way.
He moved up a step, and she took his place, peering out of the tiny window.
That's it,
she said.
That's it. Now, quick. Three red lights shine clearly on the spot.
She turned around. By some freak, the old bull's-eye glass of one of the panes in the window acted as a lens, focusing the distant flashes onto a spot in the stone wall, a spot where the stone was loose, as she discovered when she dug her urgent claws into the soft mortar it was set in. She pulled the stone out. It was only the size of a brick. She gave it to Mr. Berry and reached inside the hole.
"Here's a box,"
she said, her voice shaking.
"Strike a match. Quick. Quick."
He put down the stone and did as she said, to see her drawing a little brass-studded box out of the hole in the wall.
"Hold it still, blast you,"
she said. But it was her own hands she was cursing. She fumbled at the lid, trying to manipulate the catch, and then the match went out.
"Strike another,"
she snarled.
"That bloody landlord will be down in a minute."
The light flared up again in his fingers. He held it close as she twisted the catch this way and that and finally forced it back. The box was empty.
"It's gone,"
she said. Her voice was quiet and shocked.
Gone, Mrs. Holland?
The ruby, you great staring toad, it was here, in this box, and someone's had it.
Bitterly she thrust the box back into the hole, after checking that there was nothing else there, and jammed the stone in place just as the door opened and the light of a candle spilled down the stairs.
All right,
came the landlord's voice.
Yes, thank you, dear. I've seen the light, and so's my son. Ain't you, Alfred?
Yes, Mother, I've seen it all right.
Much obliged to you,
said Mrs. Holland as they left the cellar.
You ain't shown anyone else down there recent, I suppose?
Not since Major Marchbanks come down here a month or two back. He was looking at the Tudor foundations, he said. Nice old gent. Killed himself the other week.
Fancy that,
she said.
No one else, then?
My girl might have let someone down, only she's not here at the moment.
Why?
No reason,
said Mrs. Holland.
It's a quaint little place, that's all.
It is that, he said.
All right, then.
Mrs. Holland had to be satisfied with that. But she said to Mr. Berry, as they waited for their train,
there's only one person who knew where that ruby was, and that's the girl. Hopkins is dead, and Ernie Blackett don't count. It's the girl. I'll have her, Mr. Berry. I'll have her, and I'll tear her open, I will. I'm angry now, and I'll have her life. You see if I don't.
Protecting the property. On Friday the 8th of November, Mr. Selby took a trip on the river. It was part of his job, occasionally, to make inspections of vessels in the docks, of cargoes in the warehouse, and to issue certificates and bills of lading. He had been a good shipping agent once. He was brisk and vigorous, and he was a good judge of the value of most goods, both in London and in foreign markets. He had an eye for a ship, and few people had been known to get the better of him in the bargain. So when the chance came up to inspect a schooner to replace the lost Lavinia, Mr. Selby took it at once, with a feeling of relief. Here was a job that didn't involve unpleasantness, that wasn't going to mix him up in anything murky or Chinese, just a straightforward shipping job. So on Friday afternoon, he travelled to the Blackwall Railway Terminus, well wrapped up against the cold, and with a flask of brandy in an inside pocket, to clear his judgment. With him went Mr. Berry. The first guardian had had an unfortunate adventure involving a policeman, a public house, and a stolen watch, and in the absence of anyone better, Mrs. Holland had sent Mr. Berry along to Cheapside.
"Where are we going, Mr. Selby?"
he said as they got off the train.
"On a river,"
said Mr. Selby shortly.
"Oh."
They walked to Brunswick Pier, where Mr. Selby had arranged for a boat to be ready to take them to the shipbuilding yards by the mouth of Bow Creek, where the schooner was tied up. The pier was deserted, but for a single skiff bobbing at the foot of the steps, with a figure in a shabby green greatcoat and a large hat holding the oars. When they arrived, the boatman stepped out of the skiff and helped Mr. Selby down. Then he turned to Mr. Berry.
"Sorry, sir," he said. "The boat'll only take two."
"But I'm supposed to stay with him," said Mr. Berry. "I got to, I've been told."
"Sorry, sir, there's no room."
"What's going on?"
called Mr. Selby.
"Get a move on, will you? I'm a busy man." He says there's only room for two, Mr. Selby,"
said Jonathan Berry.
"Well, take the oars and row yourself," said Mr. Selby. "Only don't hang about."
"Very sorry, sir," said the boatman. "Company policy not to hire out a boat without an employee aboard. Nothing I can do, sir,"
Mr. Selby snarled with impatience.
Oh, very well, you stay here. What's the name? Don't stir from this pier.
All right, Mr. Selby, said his bodyguard.
He sat down on a bollard, lit a short pipe, and watched placidly as Mr. Selby was borne away on the turbid river. And it was not until they came close to the pier at 6 o'clock, and found him still sitting there, that he realized that anything was wrong.
"You bloody great cold fish,"
said Mrs. Holland, and then she treated him to an analysis of his character, a list of his ancestors, and a prognostication of his future.
"But he told me to weigh himself,"
protested Mr. Berry.
"You don't realise what's going on, do you? You don't realise what you've done at all, do you, you great big stone?"
"Only because you won't tell me,"
muttered the big man, but he dared not say it aloud. For Mrs. Holland had by now become so obsessed by the ruby that she could see nothing else. Mr. Selby had been a temporary interest, promising for a while, but with nothing like the gripping fascination of the other. She ejected the few lodgers she had, so as to have the house clear, and hung a sign saying, "No vacancies," on the front door. She dispatched spies to all parts of London to look out for Sally and Adelaide, and just in case, for a photographer with fair hair as well. She drove Mr. Berry into a state of acute nervousness, in which her least movement made him start, her least word made him jump, and her sudden appearance in a room make him jump up like a guilty schoolboy. She padded around the house, muttering and cursing. She prowled around the edges of her territory, from Wapping Old Stairs to Shadwell Basin, from Hangman's Wharf to the line of the Blackwall Railway, fixing her glittering eyes on every young girl she saw. She did not sleep, but sat up in the kitchen, brewing tar-like tea and sleeping in snatches. Mr. Berry walked on tiptoe and spoke very politely. As for Sally, she felt lost. She had bought a weapon, but she didn't know her enemy. She had learned about her father's death, but she could see no reason for it. And days were going by. She felt that she had started something with her first visit to Cheapside that was now out of control. Things were evolving obscurely around her, like great dangerous machines in a darkened factory, and she was walking blindly among them. She knew she could learn more, but at the cost of another journey into the nightmare. And she couldn't pay that, not yet. It was so ironic, because for the first time she had friends, and a home, and a purpose. With every day that passed, she felt more secure in her knowledge of the business, and more full of ideas for developing it. Unfortunately, most of them cost money, and there was no capital available. She could not use hers, because she could only get at it through Mr. Temple, and if she went to him, she would lose her independence at once. It was easier to think about Frederick. Such a mixture of lazy flippancy and passionate anger, of bohemian carelessness and dedicated perfectionism. Frederick was a topic to fascinate any psychologist. She thought, I must ask him to teach me photography. But later, not yet, not until I'm free of this mystery. With an effort, she turned her mind back to the darkness, back to Mrs. Holland. So the young woman and the old one each found their thoughts occupied by the other, and when that happens to people, sooner or later they meet. Early on Saturday morning, a man and a boy in a barge laden with horse manure spotted a body in the water in that part of the river known as Erith Reach. With the aid of a boat hook, they got it on board and laid it ceremoniously on top of their floating dunghill. It was the boy's first corpse, and he was very pleased with it. He wanted to keep it for a while and display it for the admiration of the passing traffic, but his father put the boat in at Purfleet and gave the remains to the local magistrates. The horse manure went on to the farms of Essex. Jim had taken to spending most of the weekend at Burton Street. He fell in love with Rosa, who had commandeered him at once for the Stereoscopic Repertory Company. He was Oliver Twist. He was a boy standing on the burning deck. He was Puck. He was a prince in the tower with Frederick as an unconvincing wicked uncle. but no matter how he was costumed or how noble the role, his features were so formed that the only expression the camera could catch on them was a cheerful villainy. They tried him once with, "When did you last see your father?" And he looked, said Frederick, as if he were persuading the parliamentarians that he could let them have a nice lot of second-hand pikes, dirt cheap.
"Here,"
he said when he came in this Saturday.
"Old Selby's missing. He never come in this morning. I bet he's been done in. I bet that geezer from the Warwick Hotel's cut his throat."
"Stand still," said Rosa, her mouth full of pins. The studio had been transformed into Palestine with the aid of a painted backcloth, and she was trying to make Jim look like the boy David for a biblical series that Trembler said they could sell to missionary societies. "When did you last wash your knees?"
"I bet he never washed his bloody knees neither. Who's going to look at this picture anyway?"
"Cannibals," said Sally.
"Well, it'll come off in the pot, won't it? You don't seem to care about old Selby. I bet he's dead."
"Quite possibly," said Rosa.
"Now will you stop jigging about, for goodness sake? We've got work to do."
A customer came into the shop, and Sally went to serve him. When she came back, she could hardly stop smiling. "Listen," she said. "Listen, this is marvellous. That was a man from Cheney's, the printers. They want to print lots of our pictures and put them on sale all over London. Already. What do you think of that?"
"First rate," said Frederick.
"Which ones?" "How much are they going to pay?" said Rosa. I told him to come back on Monday. I said we were too busy to discuss it at the moment, but we'd had offers from several other firms, and we'd have to weigh them up. When they come back...
"You didn't," said Rosa. "But that's not true."
"Well, perhaps not yet, but we will. I'm just anticipating a little to put the price up. Frederick, when they come back, you must deal with them. I'll tell you what to say."
"I hope you will. I wouldn't have the least idea." "Oh, have you seen this? I meant to show you earlier."
He folded back a copy of the Times.
"For heaven's sake," said Rosa crossly, "are you going to take any pictures today or not?"
"Of course I am," he said. "But this might be important. Listen. Miss Sally Lockhart. If Miss Sally Lockhart, daughter of the late Matthew Lockhart, Esquire, of London and Singapore, will inquire for Mr. Reynolds at the Warwick Hotel, Cavendish Place, she will learn something to her advantage. What do you think of that?" Jim whistled.
"That's him," he said. "That's the bloke what killed Selby."
"It's a trick," said Sally. "I'm not going."
"Shall I go and pretend to be you?" said Rosa. "Don't go," said Jim. "You'll cut your throat, same as he did old Selby's."
"What do you know about Selby?" said Frederick.
"You're obsessed, you horrible little boy."
"Betcha," said Jim at once.
"Betcha half a crown he's dead."
"Done," said Frederick. "Sally, I'll come with you if you like. He couldn't do anything if I was there."
"Supposing it's Mr. Temple, though," she said. "You keep forgetting that I'm supposed to be hiding. He's legally responsible for me, so he's bound to be trying all kinds of ways to find me again."
"But it might be something to do with your father," said Rosa. "He's called you Sally and not Veronica, for a start."
"That's true. Oh, I don't know what to do. But, oh, I don't know. There's too much to do here. Let's get on with this picture."
On Sunday afternoon, Adelaide and Trembler went for a walk. They went past the British Museum, down the Charing Cross Road, and looked at Nelson on his column. Then they strolled along the Mall, and went to pay a call on Her Majesty the Queen, only she wasn't in, for the Royal Standard wasn't flying over Buckingham Palace.
"She must be at Windsor," said Trembler. "Just like her. Let's have some hot chestnuts instead."
So they bought some chestnuts and walked through the park, and saved some bits to give to the ducks, who came and fought for them like little battleships. Adelaide had never dreamed of an afternoon like this. She laughed and joked with Trembler as if she'd forgotten how to be unhappy, and he laughed too and taught her how to skim stones across the water, until a park keeper came and told them off. Then when his back was turned, Trembler stuck out his tongue and they both burst out laughing again, which was when they were spotted. A young worker from the sawmill behind Wapping High Street was out walking with his best girl, a housemaid from Fulham. He had had dealings of a mildly criminal nature, tobacco extracted from a warehouse, with one of Mrs. Holland's lodgers, and remembered that that lady was offering a reward for news of Adelaide's whereabouts. He was a sharp-eyed young man, and he recognized her at once. He steered the best girl away from the path they were treading, and began to follow Adelaide and Trembler.
"Here,"
said the housemaid.
"What you doing?"
"Just act natural," said the young man. "I got me reasons." "And they're your sort of reasons," said the housemaid. "I ain't going in no bushes with you. Give over."
"Cheerio, then," he said, and left her, astonished, on the footpath. He followed them out of the park and up through Trafalgar Square. He lost them at the bottom of St. Martin's Lane, and then nearly ran into them in Cecil Court, where they were gazing into the window of a toy shop. He kept up with them as far as the British Museum, nearly lost them in Coptic Street, tried to stay further back and out of sight because the crowds were thinner up here, and then had to get closer because it was getting dark, and finally saw them turn the corner of Burton Street. When he got there, they had vanished, but the door of a photographer's shop was closing. "Well, that's something anyway," he thought, and hurried off, back to Wapping. King James's Stairs. The man from Cheney's, the printers, came on Monday, as Sally had arranged. Frederick, well rehearsed, insisted on a royalty of 20%, rising to 25% after 10,000 copies had been sold. The printer was taken aback by this. He had expected to make a single payment and buy the pictures outright. But Sally had thought of that and told Frederick not to budge. The printer agreed to take the historical series, the famous murders, and the scenes from Shakespeare. He also agreed that the pictures should be known as Garlands and not Cheney's, that they should be sold at a price of 2 and 6 pence a set, and that they, the printers, should bear the cost of advertising. Slightly bemused, the printer left, but not before he had signed an agreement. Frederick rubbed his eyes, unable to believe what he'd done. "That was just right," said Sally. "I was listening. You were firm, and you knew just what to say. We've started. We're on our way." "I'm a mass of nerves," said Frederick. "My soul is too fine for this commercial jousting. Why don't you do it?" "I shall, as soon as I'm old enough to be taken seriously." "I take you seriously?" She looked at him. They were alone in the shop. The others had gone out for various things. He was sitting on the counter. She was standing a yard or so away with her hands on the wooden rack Trembler had made to hold the stereographs. And she was suddenly very conscious of all this. She looked down. "As a businesswoman," she said, trying to keep her voice light. "As all kinds of things. Sally, I..." The door opened, and a customer came in. Frederick jumped down from the counter and served him while Sally went through into the kitchen. Her heart was beating fast. What she felt for Frederick was so confused and powerful that she couldn't begin to articulate it. She hardly dared think what he had been going to say. Perhaps in another minute or two she would have found out. But then there was a bang on the kitchen door, and in strolled Jim. "Jim," she said, "what are you doing here? Aren't you at work?"
"I came to collect me winnings," he said. "Remember I made a bet with the governor? Well, I was right. Old Selby's dead."
"What?" Frederick came in at that point and stopped short.
"What are you doing here, Gargoyle?" he said. "I come to tell you some news. You owe me 0.5 crown for a start. Old Selby snuffed it. They fished him out the river on Saturday and we had a cop around this morning and the place is closed. There's investigations going on. So let's have me money."
Frederick threw him a coin and sat down. "What do they know about it?" he said.
"He went off on Friday to look at a schooner near Bow Creek somewhere. He took a skiff at Brunswick Pier and it never come back. Nor did a boatman. That big fella of Mrs. Ollens was with him up till the pier, but he never went on the skiff because there's a witness as saw him wait him. What do you think of that, then?"
"Blimey," said Frederick.
"And do you think it was the man from the Warwick Hotel?" "Of course it was. Stands to reason."
"And did you tell the police that?"
"What for?" said Jim scornfully. "Learn whistle."
"Jim, this is murder."
"Selby was a villain," said Jim. "He sent her dead to his death, remember? He don't deserve no better. That ain't murder, that's natural justice."
They both looked at Sally. She felt that if she said, "Yes, we'll go to the police," the other two would agree. But a part of her mind insisted that if they did, she would never learn the truth. No, she said. Not yet. This is dangerous, said Frederick. To me, not you.
That's why I'm concerned, he retorted angrily.